The third and final case on today's oral argument calendar is case number A22-1108, Stuart Edward Underhill versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. I know both attorneys are familiar with our rules. You each have 15 minutes for your initial or principal argument, and appellant's count, you will have an opportunity for rebuttal. You may take your choice of our lecterns. The one in the center has the light system, and it also has a button to adjust the height of the lectern, up or down. Counsel for appellant, you may begin. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Charles Ramsey, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Stuart Underhill. This appeal is to determine whether Minnesota's revocation laws are in conformity with Wisconsin's and whether the procedure used here violated Mr. Underhill's due process rights. First, I'll discuss the constitutional requirements of blood draws. Schmerber was a seminal case from 1966. Blood draws and testing of those blood draws are searches, which implicate the Fourth Amendment. Warrantless blood draws are unconstitutional unless subject to one of the well-recognized exceptions of the warrant requirement. Those exceptions include exigency with probable cause, consent, but it does not include single-factor exigency or, with respect to blood test cases, search incident to arrest. Consent must be obtained. It can't be extracted under George and Bumper. Consent must be freely and voluntarily given. Mere acquiescence to a show of authority is insufficient under Bumper. With that constitutional backdrop, I'll turn to Minnesota's pre-hearing revocation law. Wisconsin's laws are not in conformity with Minnesota's. Minnesota statute 171.177 before 2017 permitted revocation for a warrantless blood draw, either for refusing or for failing the test, in other words, being 0.08 or more. But after Birchfield, the legislature amended 171.177, and they changed it. The commissioner today, as a result of that amendment, is not permitted to revoke a person's license extrajudicially in the case of a warrantless blood draw. Conversely, Wisconsin's law, I believe it's 343.305, does permit pre-hearing revocation even for warrantless blood draws. For those reasons, primarily, the Commissioner of Public Safety is not permitted to revoke a license for a warrantless blood draw.
Mr. Ramsey, in the commissioner's responsive brief, the first argument there is that the Anderson opinion of the Supreme Court governs, and that's sort of the beginning and the end of the analysis, and there's no need to consult a lot of the other case law that you cited, which is mostly criminal case law. And in fact, I think the commissioner's first argument is that it's improper to look at all that case law. The only question, a rather simple question, is was there a conviction in a foreign state that of an offense that is unlawful in Minnesota? Can you address that argument at the beginning? Because I think it's a threshold argument or issue. I mean, we might not get to a lot of the other specific issues about Birchfield and Brooks and everything else unless we first determine that the analysis leads us there.
I understand, Your Honor. And I do believe that if there is a criminal conviction that arises out of these circumstances, that the Commissioner of Public Safety in Minnesota is then allowed to revoke. Just like in Minnesota, the police officer can conduct a blood search, seizure and search, without a warrant, using one of the exceptions to the warrant requirement. However, the commissioner can't revoke extrajudicially unless there's a warrant. So if the officer gets or obtains the blood sample.
Can I stop you again? Because, I mean, what if, I mean, I guess if these Fourth Amendment issues are raised in the criminal case, that's one thing. But if they're not, and if a criminal case reaches conviction and finality, then must the commissioner, you know, make inquiry into the procedures that led to that conviction? Isn't that just simply, once the conviction is final, aren't those procedural issues no longer relevant?
And it's interesting that you use the word conviction, Your Honor. To this day, Mr. Underhill has not been convicted.
So, on that point, paragraph 5 of the district court's order, quote, the record establishes Underhill was convicted in Wisconsin, blah, blah, blah. I didn't see you challenging as clear error paragraph 5 of the district court's order.
And that's unfortunate, Judge, but I think what it does is it goes to that it is a de novo review, whether or not the commissioner can revoke based on the information provided to it. The district court wrote that the information from Wisconsin to the commissioner in and of itself is insufficient to revoke under the law, but then held that it's the commissioner's own documents that corroborate Wisconsin's notice, and therefore there is a proper basis to revoke. And so—
Right, but you're not challenging that, and I want to get back to Judge Johnson's question. So in my view, there's no difference between a situation in which there is a conviction in a situation in which there wasn't, but it's not being challenged as a factual matter to this court. We are going to, with absent a challenge, I think we have to accept those findings. And so that gets you back to Judge Johnson's question, I think, which is, assuming a conviction, or in this case, no argument that that was erroneous, we're limited to these findings, then how do you answer Judge Johnson's question?
I know we didn't brief it, Your Honor, but the trial court had no basis to find that there was a conviction. Even the commissioner, in its findings of fact, didn't argue that there's a conviction. At the hearing, there was no argument in the transcript or otherwise that there was a conviction. As an officer of the court, I stand before you today. There is no conviction out of Wisconsin arising out of these circumstances.
And I guess maybe we need to clarify, but there was some judicial adjudication, correct? Is this because Wisconsin has different procedures there too? I mean, I see the phrase administrative adjudication on one of the exhibits.
There is some reference to administrative, but not judicial, Your Honor. He was not convicted of a crime.
Well, that exhibit one, which is on letterhead of WISDOT, Wisconsin Division of Motor Vehicles, says conviction date August 7, 2021.
I understand it says that, but there is no conviction. The trial court even found.
Which trial court?
The trial court in this case in Minnesota, from which we are appealing, that the Wisconsin documents in and of themselves.
Right, that's also paragraph 5. But as I said before, paragraph 5 starts with a pretty clear statement that there was a conviction. Paragraph 8 also says the commissioner established Underhill's conviction on August 7th, 2021. And again, I didn't see any challenge to that.
And that was an oversight. That finding of fact should have been something that we briefed. And I concede that's not briefed, Your Honor.
But if we can get back to Judge Johnson's question, you know, let's assume that this conviction is in some way final. There is a conviction, and maybe you want to think of it as a hypothetical, and that gets us to there. What then, right? If it is a final conviction, and there wasn't a challenge in that criminal case, and now there is.
That brings us to the due process part, Your Honor. And, you know, maybe 6 years ago, no one would have considered that one state government would pass laws that would be in clear violation of the federal Supreme Court's laws, or federal Supreme Court rulings. I've already mentioned Schmerber. I've mentioned Bumper. I've mentioned Birchfield. And despite those cases, the Wisconsin legislature passed a law that said it will coerce, not, characterizing, thank you, what the law allows. The trial court in this case said that because my client wasn't threatened with physical punishment or criminal sanctions, that it wasn't coercive. What the trial court did was imply that there is a line that can be crossed before we as a state will refuse to sanction that other state's conduct. Now, I concede that he wasn't specifically threatened with criminal laws or physical
punishment.
And I
think now you're relying probably on Schmidt and other cases, right? Schmidt for the notion that a Minnesota court will entertain a collateral attack on a conviction of another state.
I am.
And that's a criminal case. And I think that was for the purposes of enhancement or criminal history scores or something. But Anderson is a civil license revocation case, and it takes a different approach. Why should we not just apply Anderson and set to the side all of those criminal cases, such as Schmidt and others?
I understand the question, at least I think I do, Your Honor. I think in large part this because this is quasi-criminal. It now forms the basis of a criminal element or an element of a criminal offense for enhancement purposes. So I think we need to look more at Schmidt than at Anderson. And again, I don't think we want to blindly rubber stamp the determinations of other states, particularly in this environment where we have fringe political groups that are taking over state legislatures and starting to do some bizarre things, including...
Mr. Ramsey, I don't want to get us off on all of the fringe possibilities here. It's a little depressing. But getting back to the point on Schmidt, let's assume we agree with you that even though Schmidt's criminal, there is a way to do it. Didn't the court in Schmidt conclude that vindication of counsel wasn't a strong enough interest in the state of Minnesota? And so there's a due process right to counsel. There's also a statutory right when we're talking about vindication of counsel. And I think Schmidt says that those rights weren't enough. So how is the due process right, or to the extent you're also arguing a Fourth Amendment issue, in addition to due process when it comes to the constitutionality of the Wisconsin advisory, how are the rights implicated in this case stronger than the vindication of counsel pretest in Schmidt?
Well, I think in Schmidt, the Minnesota Supreme Court analyzed the Minnesota's constitution limited pre-right to counsel. It did not analyze, if I recall correctly, the statutory.
Same question, though.
So
I agree that there's a constitutional and a statutory right to pretest counsel advice. Whether you call it constitutional or statutory, it probably is harder for you to get around that if it's a constitutional right, because that sounds somehow stronger of an interest than just a mere statutory one. But regardless, I think the court in Schmidt held that that interest wasn't strong enough. And so you have to convince us that this interest is stronger than the one in Schmidt.
So it goes to the statute or the conformity of the statute. And so if we're looking at the conformity of the written words in the statute, that's where the state constitution doesn't come into play. And that is something the words of the statute, at least the pre-testing right to counsel, wasn't addressed in Schmidt. And I think that's a distinguishing factor, Your Honor. And here again, the Commissioner of Public Safety does not have the power or the jurisdiction to revoke a person's license where the blood was obtained without a warrant. It just doesn't permit it unless there's a conviction. And then we go down that road, whether there was a conviction. But nowhere in the hearing was it mentioned that there was a conviction. The trial court mentioned that my client didn't.
And I don't want to get back to that point, but, you know, paragraph 8 does conclude with you know, pretty clear statement that the district court said that Underhill didn't present any evidence. So it's difficult for us to reach a different conclusion. You know, Underhill produced no evidence that established this was incorrect or that he was not, in fact, subject to a conviction. So it's difficult for this court to make a finding that's contrary to that if, in fact, there was no evidence presented.
And I understand, we didn't brief it, and we didn't specifically challenge it, mea culpa. But at the same time, at the hearing, it was the only allegation from the commissioner was that there was a revocation from Wisconsin. My client wasn't put on notice that there was an allegation of a conviction. And for that reason, we didn't address it at the hearing.
If getting back to Judge Johnson's question, if there was a conviction, is that fatal to your arguments here under Anderson?
It's likely unless due process renders that invalid.
Could I ask you to explain, what do you mean by due process? Or in other words, what type of due process argument would overcome Anderson?
Thank you, Your Honor. The trial court implied that had my client been threatened with criminal sanctions or had he been threatened with physical punishment, then the due process clause might, or due process rights might prevent the trial court from rubber stamping the revocation. And so that's where I'm going with that one, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ramsey. Counsel for respondent, you may approach and introduce yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ryan Pesch and I represent the respondent in this matter, the Commissioner of Public Safety. This court should affirm the district court's determination that appellant's license was properly suspended when respondent received notice from Wisconsin that appellant had committed a DWI offense in Wisconsin. There are three separate grounds for affirming in this case. The first is that the suspension was authorized by statute and required by rule. The second is that appellant's challenge to the adequacy of Wisconsin's procedures is not properly before a Minnesota court. And the third is that even if the court did consider appellant's challenge, the record doesn't establish that appellant's decision to undergo testing was unconstitutional. At the outset, I'd like to clarify that the issue before this court is not whether Wisconsin acted appropriately. The question is whether respondent's actions were arbitrary and capricious when they relied upon the information received from Wisconsin. The test isn't, did Wisconsin violate appellant's rights? The question is whether or not, based on the information that it received, respondent acted in an arbitrary manner. And I think skipping ahead to the Brooks analysis would ignore what the duty of this court, which is to decide whether or not appellant's offense that occurred in Wisconsin justifies the suspension that he is faced with in Minnesota. The court has already discussed the case that respondent believes applies here, that Anderson decision makes it clear that what this court should do is look to the elements of the offense in Wisconsin, decide whether or not that offense, if it occurred in Minnesota, would justify the suspension, and then end its inquiry if the suspension is appropriate.
If I may, Mr. Pesch, the distinction between, you know, this administrative suspension or revocation remedy and the use of a prior conviction for purposes of enhanceability in a criminal case, that distinction seems apparent, but it wasn't clear. What is the best authority to say that? Is it Anderson? Is it this unpublished Henriksen case? And if it is Henriksen, do you think we should consider making a precedential, essentially making Henriksen's holding precedential?
Well, I think Henriksen is the most on point factually and analytically. And I certainly would not be opposed to the court issuing a precedential opinion, clarifying that law for future cases. And I think that would be appropriate if the court decides that this is an issue that further clarification would provide some guidance on. But I don't think that a precedential opinion is necessary because I think Anderson is clear and the application of Anderson in this case isn't a novel concept. So I don't know that a precedential opinion is required here, but certainly if the additional clarification would be appreciated. And
on that latter point, I guess the district court wrote a long order analyzing, you know, applying a lot of case law and analyzing a lot of issues in order to get to the result, and it seems like, how did that happen in the district court? You were counsel then. I mean, did you raise those issues? Did your opposing counsel, did you argue Anderson primarily?
Well, in district court, the record was a little confusing because it was appellant's position there that this should be tested under the laws of 169A53, which is Minnesota's implied consent evidentiary law. And so it was unclear at that time which statute we were proceeding under. Once it became clear that this was actually a challenge under 171.19, the administrative, the challenge to whether or not the revocation was appropriate based on the fact that this was an out-of-state offense and the administrative procedure was appropriate. I think that provided a clearer pathway to make argument on whether or not the respondent's action was appropriate. So at the hearing, it wasn't clear which route we were taking, but then in briefing, the district court did receive argument on which law applies, and I believe argument there was focused on the fact that Wisconsin should be the forum in which these laws are tested, and the burden here is just whether or not appellant's offense from Wisconsin would provide a ground for suspension if it was committed here.
The Henriksen opinion relied in part on section 171.50, which incorporates the interstate driver license compact, Henriksen quoted paragraph 4A2 of the compact. The district court in this case cited that provision as well. You do not cite it in your brief. I'm wondering why. Do you think it applies here? And if so, how does it apply?
Well, Your Honor, Wisconsin, I don't believe, is a compact state. So to the extent that the district court relied on the interstate compact, I don't think that we would be raising that issue on appeal, but I don't think that that means that the district court's analysis on the whether or not the underlying offense would provide grounds for suspension if it occurred here, I don't think that renders that conclusion erroneous in any way.
I'm curious how many states are members of the compact.
I believe all but three, but I could be wrong about that.
Okay, thank you. Am I correct that in Minnesota, if a person refuses a test, that's grounds for revocation or suspension of the driver's license?
That's correct, Your Honor. And obviously in Minnesota, there's also a separate criminal charge that would apply, but the district court properly noted on, I believe it's page 12 of its order, that post-Birchfield, there were two routes that states could go with regard to incentivizing consent to blood and urine tests. The first is the one that Minnesota took, which was to start seeking warrants in order to continue to threaten criminal penalties, and the other was to not threaten criminal penalties at all, but rather focus on civil penalties. And there's dicta in Birchfield that indicates that the Supreme Court looks favorably upon the imposition of civil penalties for refusal. And I think the district court here wasn't erroneous in citing to that post-Birchfield analysis, and I think shows that even if this court were to reach that issue of the Birchfield, whether Birchfield should apply, it isn't obvious that respondent or appellant's conduct here, if Minnesota were to impose the same breath test advisory that Wisconsin uses, I don't think that it would violate the Constitution.
Are you aware of any case law in Wisconsin? Obviously, it's probably been challenged I didn't see in appellant's brief, assuming we got that far, I didn't see their citing to any case law that would hold that this advisory, the Wisconsin advisory as given here under some Wisconsin law or Wisconsin court case would be unconstitutional, either for due process or Fourth Amendment.
Well, and I don't want to go too far beyond the briefs here because I acknowledge that we didn't brief the constitutionality of Wisconsin's procedures in Wisconsin. It's again, my position that this court shouldn't be reaching that, but there are a few Wisconsin cases on the breath the advisory that's given in Wisconsin. Specifically, there's a Nord case that is at 625 Northwest 2nd 302, which discusses whether or not the Wisconsin advisory overstates or understates the consequences for refusal. That case was from 2001. I wasn't able to find anything post Birchfield to discuss whether or not the advisory as it currently stands is in conformance with Birchfield. But again, my position would be that if appellant thinks that his conduct or the state's Wisconsin's conduct violated due process, he should be raising that in Wisconsin court. And that would be the appropriate forum. That's where the testimony of the officer could be adduced at hearing, and the court could make a credibility determination on whether or not he appropriately relied on the advisory he was given and what factors the court should be considering here. The record is just, it's a little chaotic because obviously this wasn't a Wisconsin case. This wasn't a Minnesota case, and we didn't have the officer here at the hearing to testify. So to the extent that appellant's challenge is to the constitutionality of Wisconsin's procedure, that should be raised in Wisconsin. And I don't think that there's enough of a record here to decide that it was arbitrary for respondent to rely on the documents it received. There's also another.
Let me give a hypothetical briefly. Let's say there's a state in which the law enforcement obtain a blood test in violation of the Constitution. As a result of that, they don't make any criminal charges. Right? It stops with the test result. But there's a notice sent to another state, and then that notice is then used to trigger administrative. So there is no way to challenge collaterally the foreign state because there's no case. Does that make a difference?
Well, I'm unaware of a notice that respondent would receive that would indicate an offense that happened without any consequences in the forum state. So normally the information that respondent receives is that a license action has been taken against someone's license in that state, and that is what respondent relies upon. So I'm not sure if the factual situation described would be or could be presented, but in that situation, there's still an opportunity for the driver to request administrative review of that suspension or revocation or whatever results in Minnesota. And if they didn't agree with that, they could appeal to this court from the administrative determination. And I don't know what this court would decide at that time, but I think that factual scenario is pretty far removed from what happened here. I also think that the fact that this is an administrative adjudication rather than a conviction doesn't affect the underlying inquiry before this court, which is whether or not the DWI conduct in Wisconsin would justify a suspension if it occurred here. The fact that the records received by respondent, I think it, at this point, it's likely that it was an administrative adjudication and that the conviction date doesn't refer to a criminal conviction, but rather the date on which appellant faced the consequences of the administrative action. I think that still is sufficient grounds for respondent to rely on the notice it received that appellant's conduct violated the DWI law.
You're saying a conviction is not required?
I'm saying that under
the law?
The plain language of Section 171.18, It specifically refers to that department records must indicate that the licensee has committed an offense for which mandatory revocation is required upon conviction. So as long as respondent's records indicate that an offense was committed, a conviction wouldn't be required. The offense, the factors of the offense would be what determines whether or not respondent's action is arbitrary or capricious.
You just read paragraph one. Is that the paragraph that applies here, not paragraph seven?
I believe both apply. So paragraph seven is the paragraph that incorporates out-of-state offenses. And then by reference to paragraph one, so paragraph seven says if a person commits an offense in a different state, that if it occurred here would be grounds for suspension, then the commissioner may suspend the license. And then paragraph one says if the person commits an offense for which suspension is required upon conviction, suspension is appropriate. So because paragraph one says a suspension is appropriate for if an offense is committed for which suspension would be, revocation would be mandatory upon conviction, paragraph seven and one jointly work to justify the suspension that occurred here. And the first paragraph indicates that the burden here isn't, it doesn't require proof of a conviction, just that the offense, if committed here, would be grounds for suspension.
And has committed an offense, does that necessarily require a conviction, or is there a different type of adjudication that could be relied upon to establish that the driver has committed an offense?
Well, and I see my time is up.
Please answer the question.
I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Well, the statutory language says the driver has committed an offense, and I'm wondering if that language necessarily requires a conviction or whether it's broader than that. Other types of adjudications could also be relied on to establish that the driver has committed an offense.
Well, Your Honor, and the statute says department records must indicate. So here, the notice that a respondent received from Wisconsin is maintained as a record that respondent has access to and may rely upon. And I think that that justifies the action taken here because the department records do indicate that appellant committed an offense for which suspension would, or revocation would be required upon conviction. I would also note that there are rules promulgated that cover whether or not respondent can appropriately act upon its records. I would refer the court to Rule 7503, 0100, and 0200 that require the action taken in this case and define what it means for the respondent to have sufficient cause to believe that an offense occurred.
Could you repeat that number, please?
Rule 7503.0200 is the mandatory suspension following a revocable offense, and then 7503.0100 defines what sufficient cause to believe means for purposes of 0200.
Do you happen to know, is that the Anderson opinion cites 171.17.7, doesn't quote it. Has the language remained the same since Anderson? Do you happen to know?
Yes, Your Honor. The language is the same for 171.17, and the language is very similar between 171.17 and 171.18, so I believe the case law that refers to 171.17 should also apply to the language under 171.18. Seeing that my time is up and no further questions, I would just ask that the court affirm the district court's determination that respondent's action in this case wasn't arbitrary. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pesch. Mr. Ramsey, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless I misunderstood Mr. Pesch, I see that he has conceded that the Wisconsin matter is not a conviction. but rather arises out of an administrative proceeding. And so that issue is not in dispute. I'll also note that in Wisconsin, a driver does have the right to challenge the revocation under the statute I signed it earlier, 343.305. But he only has 10 days to do so, and that's for residents of Wisconsin or others, including this case where we have a Mr. Underhill, who's a resident, obviously, of Minnesota. Did he have a fair opportunity to do that? The laws are not in conformity. How far does a state have to go to violate a person's due process rights? Does it require, as the court says here, the trial court in this case says, threats of physical punishment or threats of criminal sanctions? I think here the procedure in Wisconsin as it relates to Mr. Underhill's case violated his due process rights in that it extracted consent. And for those reasons, I believe his due process rights were violated, and we as a state should not just rubber stamp those actions of another state. And I would ask that the court overturn the revocation here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsey. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. That is the final argument on today's calendar, so the court is now adjourned.